If you haven't already, explore the many ways to connect with our show. Watch full uncut conversations on YouTube, gain AIA-approved continuing education credits through Arcademy, and make sure to check us out and follow us on social media at Detailed Podcast. This is an original podcast by RCAT. Try the number one most used website for finding building product information and save time and money. No registration is required with RCAT, so try it today and get ahead on your next project. Visit RCAT.com. That's ARCAT.com.
You know, because we're pioneering the system, other manufacturers recognize what we were doing as something really special. So there were companies that wanted to get in on this business who set up lawn chairs sitting outside our building, watching the installation, seeing the process, and taking pictures. But George Brown's mandate is to educate and to teach and to share. So we welcome them in. And now some of those people sitting there in lawn chairs outside have developed systems that are now in use. Since this project started, since Limberlost started, I think there's now at least four major manufacturers of prefabricated envelope in our jurisdiction. And they're beautiful. And they've advanced decades in a very short period of time.
This is Detailed, an original podcast by RCAT. I am your host, Charisse Lakeside, senior specification writer at RDH Building Science and fondly known as the CSI Kraken. We will speak with professionals who share their insights into the most complex, interesting, and odd building conditions and the ingenuity it took to make it work. Join me as I pull back the curtain on the building industry and uncover the lessons learned. You'll gain valuable knowledge to help you better navigate your next project. My guest today is Phil Silverstein, Bachelor of Architecture, AATO, Lead AP BD&C, GRP, partner at Moriyama Tashima Architects with offices in Toronto and Ottawa, Canada. Phil brings over two decades of experience managing some of the firm's most ambitious sustainable projects. Known for his calm leadership and technical expertise, he has guided the delivery of transformative buildings such as Limberlost Place at George Brown College, the OSSTF headquarters, and the TMU Center for Urban Innovation. Phil's collaborative approach and deep knowledge of mass timber, low-carbon design, and construction management ensure that each project he leads is efficient, innovative, and environmentally responsible. The project we're talking about today is Limberlost Place at George Brown College in Toronto, Ontario, Canada. Love those Canadians. But before we get started, don't forget to take a look at the project photos and drawings as you listen along. You can click the link in our show notes or visit www.rcat.com/podcast. Limberlost Place rises on Toronto's waterfront as a living lesson in how architecture can embody environmental stewardship, innovation, and human connection. Home to George Brown College's School of Architectural Technology and the Brookfield Sustainability Institute, Limberlost Place brings education, research, and community life together under one sustainably crafted roof.
The client is George Brown College. They're a college in Toronto. They have three campuses, and they're quite large. They have a significant student body. So they canvassed their student body, and they looked at not just the current needs, but the future needs of students. And what they found is that the existential crisis that is climate change, the climate crisis, is real for these students. They're living in a very different world than I did growing up. And the result of this canvassing is that they wanted a building that was sustainable, that had green features, but they also wanted the building to attract a diverse group of students. And if you're attracting students, you need to do something special and unique. And sustainability was that king pillar that they were. It was part of the mandate. It resonated with the students in a significant way, and that became the basis of the design brief.
The 10-story mass timber building serves as both an academic hub and a working demonstration of low-carbon construction, embodying George Brown College's vision for design, innovation, and environmental leadership.
One of the asks was, this has to be a demonstration building. We want this building to be a vehicle for learning, a vehicle for education. So the building had to inhibit aspects that the students can learn from just by witnessing and looking at the building. So that's why the design brief was, they wanted to be a smart building. They wanted passive technologies. They wanted to push the envelope in mass timber and do something unique. They wanted to be an example of mass timber and sustainable technologies. Now, if it's a school of architecture, so it makes sense that you would want that design brief or that design concept for those students. But I think that if it was, a medical school, we would want something similar. We would probably come up with very similar solutions because for us, it was about reducing operating energy, low carbon technologies, low carbon building materials, and reducing the overall operating energy for the life of the building. Now, you'd want to do that with any building you design. For the School of Architecture, we had very strict requirements and program needs that the college gave us. And we had some room to navigate in the social spaces, in the communal spaces, but in the classrooms and the learning spaces were quite prescribed.
When we conceived of the project, there were a few things that really drove our design submission. One of them was to actually embrace the constraints of the project, which at times seemed overwhelming. To do a building that was so far out there beyond what anything had been done before.
This is Carol Phillips, also partner at Moriyama Tashima Architects.
It was easy to say, well, you know, maybe you could be timber and flexible, but maybe you're not going to be timber, flexible, and net zero, or pick one, pick two. We decided that we were going to pick all of them. And that's when we really started to engage in a highly collaborative process to come up with some really remarkable ideas about how to make a building that really fit into, but also stood out in Toronto, and one that made all of the sustainability features so visible and accessible that it could really change the way people felt and thought and used buildings. I think one of the ideas that we had as a team was not to make a building that was so unique that ideas couldn't be borrowed or transferred to other buildings. We actually wanted to come up from the structural to the natural ventilation, to the daylighting, to even the way we share knowledge, to make sure that everything we were doing could inspire others to actually try to aspire in some way to these new ways of building, because we need to. We need a low carbon future, and buildings are a huge part of the carbon formula.
The project's intent was twofold: to create an inclusive environment for a diverse student body, and to exemplify how architecture can embody the fullest expression of sustainability through place.
I think it came down to them wanting to be leaders in the industry. If you're attracting talented students, a diverse group of students, you need to demonstrate that you're going above what the average educational facility would provide. That's you're attracting the good students. They also had a commitment for not just environmental sustainability, but financial sustainability. So sustainable buildings, by nature, you operate on a lower budget. The mechanical systems are reduced, your building envelope is tighter, often you have better daylighting, so you have reduced lighting loads. That all comes part and parcel. So, and also, you know, colleges and universities are places of higher education. So they want to demonstrate that in their buildings. They want to show that they are higher and they're educating to it at a different level. It's, governments, post-secondary institutions. I think that's part of their mandate to be leaders. And George Brown, in this case, took that leadership role.
In collaboration with Acton Austria Architects, Moriyama Tashima Architects won the design competition, which would encapsulate this massive project and all of its unique facets.
2017 is when the International Design Competition RFP was released. Late 2017. So 2018, we responded. We brought together a team. We joint ventured with Acton Austria out of Vancouver. And we looked at the design brief from George Brown. I mentioned earlier, low carbon, future-proofed. They're looking for mass timber, smart building. They are looking for a project that created a mass timber solution that was transferable to all building typologies. It had to house the School of Architecture Studies. At the time, it was also the School of Computer Studies, of teaching daycare. George Brown has a School of Early Childhood Education, and they wanted the daycare to be fully wired in so that the students can learn from their classroom and through CCTV cameras and mics and speakers. There's a fitness center. You mentioned architectural students work late at night. Well, they need to let off some steam. 3 a.m, there's a climbing wall in this building. There's a pickleball court, cardio and weight room in the lower level. There's auditorium spaces, a conference space, a faculty office on level 9, and level 10 is an event space. Not a mechanical room, but an event space, which is very unique. Starting from the top down, it is really a space for teaching. It's primarily classrooms sprinkled with other active spaces like the event space, the daycare, the fitness center. But what makes the building really unique is how we wove social spaces throughout the full height of the building. It's a 10-story building. I should also mention it is the first exposed mass timber assembly occupancy building that's at that height, at 10 stories in North America. It's so unique. It's a unicorn of a building. We call it a demonstration building because it's demonstrating really unique and innovative solutions. But, you know, back in 2018, you could not design a mass timber building that was an assembly occupancy higher than 2 floors. This is 10 stories. In terms of building area, gross area, we're about 10 times larger than the Ontario Building Code would allow. So, you know, the building code basically said, thou shall not design in wood for a building of this typology. And when I say assembly occupancy, I don't know if that means much to many people, but really it's a building where people assemble. It's classrooms or it's an event space. It's where you have large amounts of people in a small footprint that may not be familiar with the building. So exiting could be a little awkward. So it pushes you into a more restrictive area of the code. If this were an office building or a residential building with the same footprint, it would likely be a 73, 75-story building to house the same amount of people. So you're packing a lot of people into a small space. The code does not want you to build with concrete or steel. So when we chose to go with a timber solution, we immediately spoke to the City of Toronto. We brought them in on day one. And they said, all right, we need to do this. We're going to work with you. We are willing partners. They immediately brought in Arup as a review panel, a peer reviewer, because City of Toronto had no clue how to review a building like this. At the time, in 2018, there was only one mass timber building in the City of Toronto, one completed building. So we really were one of the first out of the starting gate. And to start with a building of this type, where we're actually trying to expose the timber, not encapsulate it, was a challenge. Some people say it was like landing a man on the moon trying to do this.
Bordered by parkland, trail networks, and existing campus structures, the project adopted a prefabricated envelope system to navigate site constraints and respond efficiently to Toronto's variable climate conditions.
So when you look at the site plan, to the east of us is a public park called Sherbourne Commons. To the north is an east-west trail system, the Martin Goodman Trail. So it's a cycling, walking, and jogging trail and a road. And then beyond that, the city skyline. South of us is a building, like right adjacent, and to the west is a building. So we're kind of boxed in by these things. But, you know, by having a park to the east of us meant that we could create a building form. We could do something maybe iconic or dramatic, which was also part of the design brief. And that shape could be viewed from a distance in perpetuity. So if you're doing something unique with the roof line, but you can never really see it or witness it, you've kind of lost that design move. But then on the other two facades where we're right up against a building, it could be challenging because you're going lot line to lot line. You can't take advantage of things like built-in PV array on the facade system because you're in shade for a significant amount of the time. But because we're building lot line to lot line, we had a very large GFA, ground floor area, gross floor area. We had to build out the entire property. We didn't have much laydown space, not a lot of staging space for construction. So we knew that the building would have to be designed mostly with crane-based activity. So the trucks could pull in, the loads could be taken off, installed, and the truck pulls off. That led to the decision to go to prefabricated envelope. Instead of site building the envelope piece by piece by piece, we went with a prefabricated envelope. We did it for the reason that I just described, but also it's a mass timber building. And you'd want to protect that, especially in our climate. We get a lot of rain, a lot of snow, a lot of ice. The weather is not ideal for, you know, 4 months out of the year in Toronto. And you need to protect that structure as it's going up. A prefabricated envelope can chase the structure and protect it. So that was a strategy from the design competition right back in 2018. The other thing with a prefabricated envelope, and we didn't want people working on swing stages, scaffolds, even we want to minimize scissor lifts. You know, we have roads surrounding us. We don't want to take over a full lane for the duration of the project. So if the prefabricated envelope came fully gasketed, glazing installed, then it just simply comes off the truck, the crane picks it up and clicks it into place.
The facade's rhythmic articulation, achieved through vertical fins and warm metallic panels, modulates solar gain and accentuates the building's slender verticality, while the expressive peak anchors its profile as a civic landmark visible across the harbor.
Let's go back to 2018. There were really no prefabricated envelope manufacturers in Canada. Rain screen principle. There are manufacturers that do, like precast concrete is a prefab system. There's other really simplified systems, but we're looking at a true rain screen principle, 100% exterior insulation, prefabricated module. Again, we didn't want any exterior caulking. We didn't want anyone on swing stages. So it had to be a fully gasketed system. We were looking for a design assist partner. We were probably at the end of DD, design development, when we brought in a design assist partner. We did look at some American manufacturers, but we were worried about tariffs. We're worried about cross-border delays. So we chose a company that we thought had the highest chance of success. They had never really done anything quite like what we were planning. In fact, no one really had done what we were planning. I'm not sure what the envelopes would look like in your region, but what we tend to do here is 100% exterior continuous insulation. We don't pack the insulation in the stud cavity. It makes for a very expensive wall system, a very thick wall system, but it is good building science. We also have a design, if you've seen the facade layout, it's a vertical oriented building with ribbon windows, vertical ribbon windows. So a lot of prefabricated panels would be one story tall. It'd be a punch window, like a donut. And we didn't go that route. We complicated things by using these long ribbon windows. So the prefabricated panels had like a weak point where the opaque panel met the glazing. We want to reduce air leakage. So we thought the larger the panels, the fewer the joints, the less air leakage. So we went double height panels, 12 meters by 4.5 meters. These panels are epic. You lay down flat, it could be the size of a swimming pool. Like, they're quite large panels. That was a big lesson learned. They were too large. It meant the logistics of getting these panels to the site was very difficult. Some of them were so large, they had to go in angles. It's only one panel per truck. And when they arrived, because we chose a vertical orientation, the panels arrive on a horizontal, you know, landscape format. And then we had to flip it to portrait in the air. I believe there are only 4, maybe 5 cranes in the city of Toronto that could perform that operation. And I think we broke them all. So if we were to do this again, we would stay horizontal. We'd make the panels much smaller. The air infiltration, the air leakage was so minimal that we didn't need to go so large. But, you know, because we were pioneering a system, other manufacturers recognized what we were doing as something really special. So there were companies that wanted to get in on this business, who set up lawn chairs sitting outside our building, watching the installation, seeing the process, and, you know, taking pictures. But George Brown's mandate is to educate and to teach and to share. So we welcome them in. And now some of those people sitting there in lawn chairs outside have developed systems that are now in use since this project started, since Limberlost started. I think there's now at least 4 major manufacturers of prefabricated envelope in our jurisdiction. And they're beautiful, and they've advanced decades in a very short period of time.
Building a mass timber structure of this magnitude required careful consideration of weather impacts, with extensive measures taken to protect the material and maintain precision during assembly.
Wood can get wet. There's nothing wrong with it getting wet, and it'll dry up quite quick. Like, you know, all these, most of the housing in North America is wood frame, and no one's ever complained about their house getting wet as they're starting to frame it, because they know that you get a couple days of dry weather, a non-rain event, it'll dry up. The only issue with mass timber getting wet is that there's often membranes and coatings you're putting on the timber. And as soon as you're encapsulating it, you're locking that moisture in. So you just have to make sure that the moisture content stays within, say, 16 to 19%. As long as you're in that range, you can attach drywall to it. You can encapsulate it with concrete toppings for acoustics. So you're just keeping it dry because you want to achieve that moisture content in the wood. But the other aspect is, if you have too much moisture, it could add staining to the wood. Water pulls dirt and contaminants from the air. It can stain the wood. If water gets trapped in there, so say you do have a membrane down or you have some other building like a tarp that's trapping that water. If the moisture stays at, say, 22% for an extended period of time and it's wet, then mold can set in, and that's a huge risk. Once you get up to 26%, you're now looking at rot setting in. Now you have structural failure. So you just have to monitor the moisture content. Make sure, actually, the best thing is just to leave it open. Allow the air to move through the structure. It'll dry up quick. If you're using a northern species of wood, like a black spruce or a jack pine, they're extremely dense. They're dense like teak. Water doesn't really penetrate into the wood. It will if it's, say, plywood or maybe the end grains, water can penetrate. So we really want to protect it because we're keeping it dry so we can build fast, put in our concrete toppings for acoustics. And if we can avoid it getting too wet and stained, then there's just less work after to clean the staining off. So in Limberlost, we happen to be erecting the timber during one of the worst winters you could imagine. Now, I say worse is not because there was a lot of snow or really cold. It was actually a warm winter. So the temperature would drop at night, it would snow, which is great if it would just snow, because then you could shovel it off. But then it would start to melt early in the morning as the sun would come up, and that melt water would run through the CLT joints. And then you might get a cold snap, and then it would freeze. Now you have ice literally between the joints. Any little pocket between the CLT panels, that's the cross-laminated timber floor panels, we had little recesses for splines. They would get filled with water, and then it would turn to ice. It was just a really difficult process trying to keep everything, all the weather out. You can't chip the ice off. If it was a concrete structure, you bring in blowtorches and you can melt it off. You can't do that in a mass timber structure. So when we didn't have the prefabricated panel up to protect the structure, we did rely on tarping. We also, on level 6, we installed a water stop floor. So there's a product called SIGA Wet Guard. We applied that product to the entire surface of level 6. We closed off vertical circulation, like all penetrations were covered and concealed and wrapped, so that it essentially acted like a roof. And once we did that, it could rain, it could snow, anything could happen, and we could work below it. We do put coatings on the wood. There's a factory-applied coating. It's a clear coat, and it's really just there for transport. So, you know, fingerprints and construction dust can be wiped off quickly, but it's a temporary coat. So then at the end of the job, usually the painter will put on an additional coat just for protection for the life of the building. We've had some issues with some of the coatings. If you don't want glare, streaking, or any discoloration, sometimes it's best just to leave it. If somebody takes a pencil and writes on it or a marker, you could sand it out. The only problem with sanding is now that the wood actually changes color over time. It either bleaches out or it patinas with age. So when you sand it, you now can see that mark. But there's techniques to get rid of those marks. It's a very forgiving material, especially a product like the Northern Black Spruce. There's a lot of different textures to the wood, different colorations. It's a blonder wood with a lot of small knots. It hides any imperfections. So you see a lot of, actually I noticed this a lot on the West Coast, where you have primarily Douglas fir being used, where there's less knots. It's a much cleaner, it's kind of a yellow orange tone to it, but you really see imperfections very clear. So they tend to use a lot of whitewashing or pickling to the wood so that you just blend it all out and hide it. We don't really do that much with the black spruce mass timber.
Limberlost Place is a masterclass in timber innovation. Its refined beamless system of glulam columns and cross-laminated timber slab bands achieves expansive column-free spans, offering adaptable studios and classrooms that can evolve alongside the programs they serve.
One of the first challenges that we came up with we embraced was that George Brown College's program for this building was primarily teaching spaces. And we wanted this building to be more than a demonstration building for what buildings could be. We wanted it to be highly functional and to really serve the client. And George Brown College's core business is teaching. So we knew we needed to make great classrooms that didn't have columns in them so everybody could see, and great classrooms that had great natural light and were inspiring spaces. So one of the first elements we did come up with was the size of the grid. We needed to make the grid span at least 9 meters because that made for a good classroom for 60, 50 students, that there wouldn't be a column in the room. And we also had a height restriction on Queens Quay Boulevard of 38 meters, which meant that in order to maximize the density, which is something that we are trying to do in our cities, is to actually build densely and build smartly and to both accommodate the population and also to be economical with our materials, we discovered the first challenge, which is timber usually requires quite a deep beam in order to span 9 meters. And so that's where the experience of our team, both Acton Austrey and Fast and Epp, our structural engineers from Vancouver, were able to steer the design towards a very shallow and thin structural system. It's wide, but shallow, and it allowed us essentially to sneak an extra story into the 38 meters along Queens Quay Boulevard.
Our engineers came up with what's called a timber concrete composite panel or a slab band. So it's a beamless system. And we did that in 18 inches or 400 millimeters. So we achieved a 9 meter span in 18 inches. That saved 500 millimeters. I know I'm going back and forth with metric and imperial. I'm sorry, but I work better in metric, so I'll stick with that. If we say 500 millimeters per floor, translate over the height of the building, we bought ourselves another floor. Also, going with a flat panel system, we eliminated any horizontal penetrations through beams. And those horizontal penetrations it's a coordination nightmare. If once you do coordinate it, the logistics of feeding those pipes through those cores, the coordination behind that is intense. If you can eliminate that coordination, eliminate any of that work, then you're ahead of the game. It also allows you to breathe back some space into the structure. You know, the typical mass timber structure with deep beams feels dense. It can feel kind of heavy. But as soon as you eliminate those beams, it just opens up the space. It allows your 3 meter floor to floor just to feel like a much more inviting, airy building. The system is 7-ply CLT with 100 mil concrete topping, and we've compositely connected them together using steel plates. So they cut in the top of the CLT panel, they cut some curved joints, rammed in some steel plates, put them on a slight angle. These are perpendicular to the slab band, put on a rebar cage, poured 100 millimeters of concrete, and now you've created a system that acts like what you'd see in a parking garage, like with a drop panel. And that, you know, that's why they do this in parking garages. Usually they're very low floor to floor. You can't afford to have a beam. So we essentially borrowed that concept and did it out of timber. Originally, we tried working purely with timber, with no concrete at all, but we just couldn't get the system to work. It was quite bouncy. It was a very live system. So to stiffen it up, we did require the concrete. Which means, you know, for most mass timber structures, the only concrete that's used, if you have to use concrete, is really anything below grade. And then you often rely on it for your toppings on the slab for acoustics to get that mass. But here we went with more concrete, just in the slab ends only, which meant that we have slightly more concrete than the average mass timber building.
Moriyama Tashima secured government funding and support to rigorously test and implement the system, ultimately making the technology accessible to the public.
The structural intent, this innovation, we couldn't have done this alone. We actually required government funding. Natural Resources Canada did provide funding for testing. So you can't just invent a new structural system and bring it out to market and install it. When you're looking at concrete or steel, or there's catalog sizing of members. You pick a size, you know what you're getting, and you bring it on site. So in this case, we had to create a proof of concept and codify it. So through our structural engineers, Fastenep out of Vancouver, developed up to 60 different tests, small to large tests, that we were looking at depth of penetration of reinforcing screws, the different types of the composite connectors. We brought it to University of Northern British Columbia and tested these to failure until we created a panel that met all the design criteria. We went out to market for contractors to analyze the different scenarios. The constructability was key and cost was key. And in the end, it was those steel curve plates that I was talking about. Those ended up being the ideal system. Once we had the proof of concept and it was gone through testing, now it's codified. It's a system that the City of Toronto would allow us to use. And because it was done through government funding, all the research that we did, all the calculations are now in the public realm. Our structural engineers posted on their website for anyone to download, for other engineers to iterate off of and to utilize it.
Inside, generous learning environments unfold around exposed timber surfaces, daylight-filled corridors, and breathing rooms that encourage collaboration and calm reflection.
We talked about this building being like being in the forest. We wanted an exposed timber aesthetic. And, you know, the part of the building expression, part of the design acumen of the main space, what we call the learning landscape, was it borrowed from a term Takaronto, which is a Mohawk word, meaning the place where trees stand in the water. Kind of like that, a direct translation. So the design architect and partner in charge, Carol Phillips, she took that concept and said, let's make the learning landscape feel like Takaronto, the place where the trees stand in the water. We have these tall, three-story tall columns. And then up on the roof or up on the ceiling, we have these very fine oak wood slats, almost like the branches. We've lined the space with unitized curtain wall to allow the light to flood in, with a lot of operable windows tied into the building automation system so that you have the air moving through and the light. And that's the first space you see when you enter. You're surrounded by wood, but you also are confronted with this large stepped feature stair. And so that stair, it's like bleacher seating, but it's also in the next to a feature stair. And there's a mezzanine level. And so this is where the students will congregate. When you go to the building, they're always sitting on those bleacher stairs. They have events where people sit on the steps and you present. But we've created, if you look in the image, you'll see different balconies popping in and out of the space. And that's to create an environment that responds to neurodiversity. The building is not going to respond properly to the student body if the students don't feel comfortable. Some will feel comfortable in the big space, but not all. Some students want to be tucked into a little corner. They want to feel that compression with a lower ceiling, but they still want to be and feel like they're in that big space. If you have mobility issues, you want to also feel like you're invited. That's why we have the balconies leaning into the space at level two, at level three, and at the ground. So we've also used this space to encourage people to use their own feet or their own legs to walk up vertically through the building. The elevators are there. They're tucked away in the corner. The signage is minimal. But what the hope is that students will literally, you know, they'll want to walk up the stairs to get to the higher levels. As you're walking up the stairs, you're going to see just beyond maybe 10 meters away is another feature stair that draws you to that. And every time you enter into a new feature stair, you see another one beyond that just draws you further up into the building. Because what we find with vertical campuses is that the energy sort of dies at level three. If you can create beautiful, warm, welcoming, diverse spaces through the full height of the building, they will get occupied. Students are going to find that space that suits their personal needs. Also through the furniture solution, different types of furniture will again suit different needs. So we created these rooms called breathing rooms. they flank the solar chimneys. And we call them breathing rooms because part of the concept of the building is to breathing, not just the natural ventilation, but breathing the space. You know, the beamless system allows to get structural breathing room and not feel so confined. But when the breathing rooms are on the flanks of the building, east and west side, that's another area that's fully glazed. There are very few fully glazed areas in the building, but it's where the air during natural ventilation mode comes from the classrooms into the breathing rooms. These are large double height spaces that have sort of more social interactive space on the lower level, more quiet contemplative spaces on the upper level with balconies looking down. And we interjected these in seven different locations throughout the full height of the building. So every single floor has those unique spaces where you either have the larger room or the balcony, and you do like a skip-stop pattern, the full height of the building. They're lined with this fine oak veneered acoustic wall panels. In all the public spaces, we've exposed the timber. We were only able to achieve 50% exposed mass timber. We chose to encapsulate in the classrooms where we knew we had ceilings anyways, and the ceilings are radiant heating and cooling panels. And that the heating is all through the ceiling panels. So there's no forced air in the building other than the raised access floor for active ventilation. So the interior spaces are, the whole building is filled with various types of social and communal spaces that respond to the neurodiversity of the student body.
Two solar chimneys flank the east and west facades, forming vertical anchor points that drive a passive ventilation strategy. These elements act as both mechanical lungs and sculptural bookends, visually communicating the building's sustainable agenda.
When we looked at the energy model, we looked at what are the items that are taking up the most amount of carbon, operational carbon. One was heating and cooling. So heating, well, it was a simple solution. Toronto is blessed with a world-class district cooling system. So we used Lake Ontario as to cool most of the buildings in the downtown core. The water, about 4 kilometers out in the lake, it's around 4 degrees Celsius, quite deep in the lake. And that's where we get our drinking water. So these large pipes pull the drinking water into the city. Well, heat exchangers can extract some of the chill off that pipe and then send a second loop through the city. So all the hospitals in Hospital Row, most of the skyscrapers don't have cooling towers and chillers. They're relying on that lake, the lake and the OnWave system to cool their buildings. OnWave has recently brought in a heating side to their plant where that waste heat from the water that has gone in is now a bit warmer. Now there's waste heat. Limberlost is the first building to tap in to the heating side of that. So heating and cooling is done through Lake Ontario. But the system didn't reach as far as our building. So we made agreements with OnWave to extend their system further east to get it to our building. And then we created a node about 100 feet down below grade is a large node because they want to use that to extend it further beyond. There's a whole new district being built in the east end of the city in the Portlands. And they want to extend that system east. So we're sort of that jump off point. We've gone through one heating cycle so far and a cooling cycle. The system works brilliantly. And that system, so you know what this means? We don't have boilers. We don't have cooling towers. It's a lot like geothermal heating, where the mechanical plant is quite small. You just have some pumps moving glycol and water through the system. The savings there, the operating savings from not having those large mechanical units is enormous. So we solved that problem just by going district energy. The next one is fan energy. So a typical building would have large air handling units up on the roof. Now, I mentioned before, we have an event space on the 10th floor. Well, if we can eliminate those large air handling units, those large fans, they use enormous amount of energy to push large volumes of air through the whole building. And if we can decentralize it and put, say, 2 small units on every single floor, then you only turn the fans on the floors where that power is needed. So if there's, say, level 5 east side is the only occupied space in the building at one moment in time, all the ERVs are shut off except for that one on that floor. So that greatly reduced the energy, fan energy. So we created a raised access floor. We pump that air through the raised access floor. That's for fresh air only. Using a raised access floor means we don't have any ductwork. It's a sealed plenum. and it allows us to achieve displacement ventilation. So you're supplying the air down low, returning up high. It's a very efficient form of providing ventilation. So now we've freed up the entire top floor. We can now monetize that space by creating an event space. The system works at a fraction of the cost than a traditional system. And it's a really comfortable form of ventilation. When we're not heating or cooling and the weather's nice outside, we have weather stations up on the roof. Those weather stations are sensing the temperature, the humidity, the wind speed, the air quality. They're sensing everything. And they're saying to the building automation system, whether it's a good or bad day to open or close your windows. So if it's a good day to open your windows, all the thermostats in the building turn green. Faculty will get a notification on their phone saying, hey, today's a good day to open your windows. The screen right in the front lobby will tell you that today's a great day to open your windows. So we physically wanted people, well, faculty and students, to have agency, that if they choose to open the windows, they can. They don't have to, we didn't want them to be motorized. So if you open a window when the thermostats are green, the ERVs will sense that. They'll shut down, and then the solar chimney windows will open and allow ventilation to go up through the solar chimneys. And it's a chimney relying on solar heat to get the air to move up through the chimney. So the east and west side of the building have a 1.5 meter deep chamber. It's through the entire height of the building from level two up to the roof. And if you can keep that air in that chimney warm, which we've done that by providing angled heat shelves, where we're allowing them to collect the solar energy to keep the air warm in the chimney, it'll allow that natural buoyancy to occur. So air will move up through the chimney. And when we're in natural ventilation mode and we've allowed the air to enter into the solar chimneys, then if the louver is open on the roof, which it will be, air will just naturally move through those chimneys. The trick with this system is, I mean, it's using an ancient old system. Like, you can look at old structures. It's something as simple as a teepee. You know, you have that, you have an oculus at the top, air moves in down low, and it just rises through the building. It's the same technology that's been used for thousands of years. But using it in a tight, airtight building, an academic building where you have acoustic requirements, how do you get the air from the classrooms into the solar chimney without allowing the noise to transfer as well? So we did work with our acoustician, our mechanical engineers, sustainability consultants to create a very unique acoustically lined air transfer grill in the ceiling to allow air to move from the classroom into the corridor, but not sound. We used really sophisticated testing to test this. Naris, our client, stood on one side of the room. I stood on the other, and we just clapped. Can you hear me? And it worked brilliantly. So the natural ventilation system relies on just, you open a window, the ERVs shut down, air flows into what we call these breathing rooms. The breathing rooms then bring the air into the solar chimneys and up through the roof. It's a big investment of GFA, right? Again, gross floor area. You've created this inner void that could be something else. It could be a classroom or whatever, but now it's just a void through the height of the building. But the payoff is, for probably 4 to 5 months of the year, the building is in off mode. There are no mechanical systems being used other than pumps moving domestic water to the bathrooms.
Combining these sustainability systems position Limberlost Place to achieve LEED Gold certification and meet the Toronto Green Standard Tier 4. Evidence of George Brown College's commitment to a climate-conscious future.
We are now, I think we just won our 28th award. We've been published in international magazines. It was just published in Azure, Plan, Detail magazine. It's made its rounds. We've spoken about this at numerous conferences around the world. Our structural engineers speak about it regularly at conferences. They've published, there's published white papers on it. So yeah, we're getting a lot of press on this. We're unbelievable. Like, the pride that we have of what we've accomplished is, I can't put words to it, but you know, it's really, it starts with the client. It starts with the client's vision, with George Brown College's vision. We designed what they asked for. If they didn't ask for it, this is not what would have been there. But also, one of the challenges that they wanted us to overcome is the 2030 challenge. You know, that's sort of that date that we all know is coming. January 1st, 2030. So The municipal sustainability code in Toronto is called the Toronto Green Standard. It's a step code. And when we started this project, there was four different tiers. No project in the city of Toronto had ever met tier four. The higher the tier, the you just don't pay development charges. That's the benefit. So we were mandated with achieving Toronto Green Standard Tier 4, the first in the city. Now, there's a ton of buildings that have reached Tier 3, but they just couldn't get to that extra threshold. And you're only going to do that if you leave nothing on the table. So we had to look at every single possible sustainability measure that exists and hit it hard and do it to perfection. And that's precisely what we did. So we just assembled a world-class team of consultants. We brought in consultant partners that we knew could deliver, that had the technological know-how and also had the inspiration and the will, that we just knew that we were all on the same page. Our sustainability consultants are Transolar out of New York. Fasten Up is our structural engineer out of Vancouver. We worked with CHM, who wrote the code on mass timber charring, and they work with the government on developing the standards for mass timber. They were our fire engineer, GHL out of Vancouver. We worked with people from San Francisco to Ireland. It was a big consultant team. But then when you look at the products that were used, it was all very close to home. The timber was local timber. The entire building envelope was a couple hours away from Toronto. So we have this international group of consultants that took local products and brought them together to create this building.
Procuring the slab band system offsite demanded close coordination among all teams, enabling them to overcome the complexities of on-site shoring.
We created these, I talked about the slab bands, the timber concrete composite panels. You have to pour concrete on top of these panels. So during design, we brought in our construction manager, PCL Construction. We brought them in quite early for construction coordination, constructability, costing, schedule. And one thing that they acknowledged is that if we install these slab bands and pour concrete on site, you have to shore it from below. Shoring kind of kills the one of the promises of mass timber, that once you lay your mass timber floor panel down, you can work below it same day, which you can't do with any other type of structure. So now if we're shoring it, we've lost that ability. And the shoring comes with a price tag. It was in excess of $3 million in shoring, and it might impact the schedule. So they suggested that we get the concrete poured in the factory in Nordique. Nordique are the mass timber suppliers. They're about an hour, 8-hour drive north of Quebec City. I mean, that is far away. So we reached out to Nordique and said, what would it take to cast these in your factory? And they said, well, you could probably only put one or two of these slab bands on the truck. We're planning on doing about 7 to 8. So now you're quadrupling a multiple of 5 times more trucks coming through. It killed the economics of it. And they're not set up to pour concrete in a mass timber fabricating factory. So PCL decided, with approval from the owner, to rent a slab band facility. Well, we called it a slab band facility. It was essentially a yard maybe 5 kilometers away from our site. And we thought we would just bring the slab bands there, cast the concrete on the ground, store them. And then when they're needed, it's just a phone call away. And that turned out to be a blessing in disguise, because we can now use the staging yard to stage all the timber. So now Nordique can send whatever they need when they want down to the site. It would just stay there. We protected it with essentially the same plastic wrap you put around boats in the wintertime to protect them. We protected the slab bands and the timber elements. And like I said, when you needed an element, you just make a phone call and 20 minutes later it arrives on site. So that was an amazing problem-solving solution that really required ourselves, the construction manager, one of the sub-trades, to all work together and create a cost-effective solution for the owner.
In constructing the mass timber bridge, Moriyama Tashima and its full team of consultants and structural engineers engaged in careful pre-planning to address unforeseen complexities before they arose.
So we worked with PCL Construction. Now, we had, there's the A-team. This is not just the A-team. This was an exceptional team from the client, George Brown College, our consultants, and PCL Construction. every single possible risk that could have happened was thought of. We had a plan A, plan B, plan C, all the way to Z. We planned out everything. So anything that could have happened, we figured we've anticipated that, and we had solutions. So a lot of, like, here's an example. There's a bridge connecting, a mass timber bridge connecting Limberlost to the Daphne Cockwell building. There's only a few mass timber bridges at height in North America. The elements came as individual pieces. They were going to go to the slab band facility, that yard, and get assembled there, but they had no idea how to actually truck that because it was so large to the site. They decided to build it on site. Now, so you can build it on site, and then you have to lift this thing and bring it up into place, lift it and twist it. So PCL thought, what are the possible things that could go wrong? Well, you have to swing it into the building. You have to swing it back into an existing occupied building. Do we have to cancel classes that day? Is this going to affect the exiting of the building? There's a parking garage below. What are the structural ability? What's the structural integrity of that parking garage? Maybe the crane we choose, the footings of that crane will be over the columns of the parking garage below. So they just thought through every possible thing. We weren't really aware of that. We all showed up in force to watch the raising of this bridge. We're all looking up to watch it spin, swing into place. You look at all the PCL crew and they're all staring down. Just, you know, I think in their minds are like, is this going to puncture through that slab? And well, no, they thought of everything. They had shoring put into the garage below. They made sure that the mobile crane was properly founded on columns or elements below. But it was just, it went off without a hitch. It was a 45-minute process. I actually had what I thought was going to be a time-lapse video of it. For 45 minutes, I held my camera, but I accidentally had it on slow-mo. So I have like a five-hour video of this thing going up. But that was just how the whole process worked. The whole project was, there could be issues. You know, everyone has a risk register in every project. And there's always going to be unknowns, but I think we found them all. There's other risks. The whole Toronto waterfront is built on landfill. There's a lot of methane. So anytime you're building in the waterfront, there's methane you have to deal with. And the soils are terrible. So we had to over-excavate. And, you know, the whole process of getting out of the ground was quite complicated. But we thought of everything. It's a really unique system. Even the waterproofing, like the lake is right there. So groundwater is 1.5 meters below grade. So we tanked the building. And just the whole idea of how do you tank a building this big with piles down a bedrock. And so the building science behind that, dealing with the hydrostatic pressures, but it just went off on without a hitch. Like we really didn't have any problems because we just thought about all the scenarios. This was not a Cape and Bray type of team, either on the architect's side or the contractor's side. No one pointed fingers. If we had an error in our drawings, they had an error in scheduling. The owner, you know, had made the wrong decision. No one pointed fingers. We were just a group of problem solvers trying to figure out the best pathway forward. We huddled together. We've become lifelong friends. It's a rarity. This is the unicorn project. With so much going on and so much risk at hand, it worked because we had the right mindset, the right team, the right mentality. The owner made sure that they had pools of contingency money in case there was an issue that happened. Yeah. So we didn't really have that crazy construction story.
For Phil, the dedication and resilience of the project team, guided by a focused mission from the client, provided a profound sense of hope.
Going through a process like this, an innovative project that ended with such success, just gave me hope. Because, you know, we're working in an environment right now where it's a race to the bottom. The lowest fee wins. How do we make it cheaper? How can we make it? Right now, we're faced with tariffs. We're faced with so much uncertainty in the market. People are canceling projects. But we went through COVID through Limberlost. Tariffs were an issue. There were labor strikes. In the end, we just through sheer grit and determination, positive attitude and collaboration, we were able to achieve greatness. And that gives me so much hope. We have other projects that we're working on that we're hoping to find that same chemistry. And if you don't have the right chemistry, then you move people in and out and you get the right people on the job. We were very careful assembling the right people on our team, the right consultants. If you do that work up front, then there's a lot of hope for doing great things. And again, I cannot You can't underestimate the power of a client that understands that, that is with you all along, that's not there just to do something fast and cheap and good. Because in this case, I think they got all three.
For Carol, the resonance of the structure and its connection to nature through innovative ventilation and the mass timber all around stands out as an immense achievement.
Well, I have to say, one of the things that I think is truly fascinating is, and I'm still trying to find out more about it, there is this term called biophilia, where, you know, the idea is that human beings are innately comfortable when connected to nature, and that can be in just surrounding you with natural materials. And I'm thrilled and interested to find out how the students appreciate the building. And one of the things that is really exciting to me is like, we go down to the building a lot. Our office is very close. And sometimes, you know, when I'm riding my bike to work or I'm coming up close to taking a call and I can do it remotely, I'll stop at Limberlaw's place and take the call there. And it's actually a place that I seek out. And I think I've heard from people as I've seen the building in use that they come over from other buildings to be in the building. And one of the things that I absolutely am thrilled about and find exciting, and even though we all designed it together with our sustainability engineers and our mechanical engineers, when the building is in natural ventilation mode and it feels super pleasant outside like it did this September, and you walk into the building and it feels like there's no real difference between the inside and the outside, and you realize the building is in natural ventilation mode and the windows are open and you're in a grand, huge space, just like you would when you go into, you know, any other major public building or the Eaton Center or something. But there's this shift that happens when you walk from the outside to the inside of a building. And sometimes that's appreciated. Like if it's really hot and sticky and you walk into the air conditioning, you're like, phew, that's great. But sometimes when it's really super pleasant outside and you walk into the building, what I've noticed is it's like there's no difference. And I actually feel it feels calming. It feels natural. And I also realize how unexpected it is. And for a person who was so involved in the project, it's surprising to me that I'm surprised. But it's just because we don't have these environments in our communities where you can actually just simply walk in. And I think to other places like in Europe, for instance, where you do walk into in and out of buildings and they don't feel tremendously different from the outside. And, you know, I've always attributed to them being older buildings or whatever. But I realize we don't have to hermetically seal ourselves off from the environment. And that's probably the source of a lot of our problems, is that we have separated ourselves from nature instead of seeing ourselves as part of it.
Limberlaw's Place is a vision for what learning environments can become. Spaces that teach through their very form, heal through their material honesty, and inspire through their alignment with the Earth's rhythms. It stands as a place where innovation and nature coexist, and where the next generation of designers learn what it means to build responsibly. Before we close out this episode, I always try to gain some additional insight from our guests about the greater industry. I was curious what Phil thought are the biggest issues architects face in our current economic and political environment, specifically in Canada.
What's happening in the States affects the world. And us being your closest neighbor, closest ally for generations upon generations, that just flipped overnight. And the turmoil, the anxiety, the uncertainty is palpable. We have owners not willing to pull the trigger on a project. They just don't know. Is it 20% tariff? Is it 50%? Is it zero? Who knows? Are still prices going to triple overnight? That's been probably the biggest issue for we're facing right now. We're seeing a lot of firms that are just scaling back. The RFPs that are, like, normally there's a certain amount of RFPs that come out in the summer, it slows down a little bit, it picks up in the fall, they're not picking up. So what we have to do to pivot is expand the regions we're working in, expand the building typology. Like, our bread and butter and most of the work we've done is in the cultural world, post-secondary. We've done a lot of museums and galleries and post-secondary projects. We need to get into housing. There's going to be a lot of money in housing. We feel we can make an impact, but it's not a world that we've really practiced in. And so we have to pivot. And I think a lot of firms are finding that in these uncertain times, you can't just do, like, if you're a firm that primarily did healthcare, well, they're not building a lot of healthcare right now. What else can you do? So everyone has to just be nimble. That's why you're seeing a lot of joint ventures. And even if you have the chops to do a project, sometimes you just have to find efficiencies. You have to change the way you're working because the fees are lower, the schedules are more compressed, everything is hyper fast-tracked. The demands from the client are extreme. You know, if you want to be creative, design beautiful work, you need time. You need space in your head to just think it through. Eventually, you have to sleep. So if you have to have a design finished almost instantly, what tools can you use to accelerate that? And so we are looking at AI. We're looking at new softwares that help advance design and help advance our thinking. It's just a big change in the market. The world is now looking elsewhere. So we're finding international architects are coming to Canada to find work. We're looking overseas to find work. Everyone is now becoming more international, which means increased competition. So it's like it's a catch 22.
I really enjoyed this conversation with Phil. I hope this episode sparks a new idea, helps you solve a problem that you've been working through, or inspires the mark that you want to leave on this world.
I believe the meaning to life is just to find happiness. And if our projects can make people find happiness and be happy in them, then we've made an impact. I think we've done that with Limberlost.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this episode and want to learn more, visit rcat.com/podcast to see photos, details, and more related project and product information that we discussed today. While you're there, take a look around rcat.com. For over 30 years, RCAT has been the resource for AEC professionals to find the right products for their project. Try RCAT and see how their tools can save you time and money and help you get ahead on your next project. Visit rcat.com. That's ARCAT.com. If you enjoyed the show, you can support us by subscribing, leaving a 5-star rating and review on Apple Podcasts, and sharing this with your friends. Thanks again for listening. We'll be back to share more stories and lessons learned to help you navigate your next project.